Welcome to Radical Remembering with psychologist Dr. Narissa Williams. This is a weekly conversation where we explore ways we've internalized oppression and consider what it really means to live liberated. Each episode would leave you with intimate knowledge of the liberation process, sprinkle a little healing magic, and leave you with wisdom for your journey. As you get settled in for today's episode, please make sure to like and subscribe. And if you've liked what you heard at the end, please share. Welcome to another episode of Radical Remembering. Today we have Angela Watrous with us. So Angela and I met and we became, I guess, fast friends once we started being friends. We were doing a training course together last year to become ancestral lineage healing practitioners. Right. So you're also what's interesting to me about this is that you're our first white person on the show.
And a huge honor.
Yeah. And there's big reason for that. Angela is somebody who I think takes her liberation journey very seriously, her anti-racism journey very seriously, and knows the language. And in a recent conversation that you and I had, you were sharing, like, yeah, I think Black people, I think maybe you were talking about people of color in general, feel comfortable around me because I don't, whatever you said, it was like, and I meant to reply to you and say that it was oversimplified. I was like, nah, I think we like you because we could talk shit about white people and you get it.
Yeah.
And, you know, not that I'm just talking shit all the time, but when I talk about the harms of racism and I name white supremacy and the long arm of, you know, capitalism and things and different things like that, there's not a lot of explaining that I have to do with you, Angela, like you just get it. And so because of that, and because of this great work that you're doing, I wanted to bring you on the show. So welcome.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. Just getting to talk to you for an hour is bliss. So yeah.
Yes, thank you. So you're working on, we can start anywhere, but I want to jump right in here and then we'll talk about other things later. But you're working on a documentary in the wake of our ancestors. Can you tell the audience a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I've never made a film before. I've written books and somehow my ancestors, once I did the ancestral lineage healing, particularly with my dad's line, I kept having images of a film. I knew that my great-great-grandfather had a town in New Mexico named after him. So anytime you have a British grandfather with a name named after him in this land, you know, there's some colonizing going on. So I knew that. I was curious about the place. My grandfather was born there. My dad had gone there as a child. I'd never been. So I kept having a sense of this. And I just packed up my new film equipment with some instructions from a friend who is a filmmaker and my dad and my dog. And we made a journey going in reverse through our ancestors' migration through the United States from 1636 to today. And as we made that journey back, we learned also that our first colonizing ancestor, Jacob Waterhouse, arrived in 1636 and in 1637 participated in the massacre of the Pequot people, which was something we had never heard of before. We didn't know anything about it. And that massacre is considered the template for the Native American genocide. So making a film about, like, how do we reckon with our ancestral harm and how, you know, because it's the core of the cultural troubles that we're experiencing today. And so the theme of the film, the question is, when you're born on land your ancestors stole, can you live here with integrity?
I love it. So what are some insights that you've had, particularly, I mean, because you're a white woman, right? And so you're thinking about this through the lens of race, right? So what are some feelings that you've had? Because a lot of times we're so, people in America in particular, so disconnected from our lineages, you came to realize, like, oh, whoa, wow, like I'm literally a benefactor of the genocide. Yeah. I'm literally, you knew this before, I'm a benefactor of white privilege and all those kinds of things. What were some of the emotions that arose for you and your father on that journey?
Yeah, I mean, it was complex because particularly when we found out about what happened with the Pequot people, there was shock and horror. I mean, our ancestors and 80 other Englishmen and some other indigenous tribes surrounded the Pequot village and burned their people alive and shot people who were trying to come out. I mean, I'm saying this explicitly because it's horrifying. And at the same time, I was in the middle of this film journey. And when I heard that my ancestor had been part of the foundational genocidal acts, you know, the United States' foundational genocidal acts against Native Americans, I was like, oh, good. I'm here to tell the story. I didn't know what story I was going to tell, but this story absolutely needs to be grappled with. It's whitewashed. It's ignored. It's changed. You know, I mean, all the narratives I grew up with in this country were like pilgrims and religious freedom and freedom for everybody. And of course, we know that's just total propaganda. White settler colonization is not immigration, as Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz just came out with a book last year called Not a Nation of Immigrants. You know, when British people and other European people came here and like tried to like just take over and instill their culture to a land, brought African people against their will here, forced them to do the physical labor and I'd say emotional labor and spiritual labor of founding this country, and then act like these white men did it. I was grateful that I got to work with the core of this story. So it was super complicated. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, I've heard people, white people say, like, I'm afraid to look at my ancestry because I don't want to see what they've done. And a lot of people talk about guilt, but to me, it's much more about grief. And I'm here for the grief of the collective troubles. And I think that we have to acknowledge them and we have to grapple with them in order to come together, because those cultural troubles were orchestrated. They weren't happenstance. They were completely orchestrated to divide and conquer working class laborers of all races so that the ruling class could divide us and conquer us. And as long as we keep kind of falling into this idea that we are somehow different because of, you know, racial identity. I mean, of course, there is white privilege and there is racist action and systemic racism. I'm not denying that, but also like, as long as we stay caught in that cycle, and we're not just like sort of looking at how to dismantle that and like come together and rise up and say, actually, you can't destroy our planet. You can't have your boot on our necks to make us just do all of the labor of this life. We have to grapple with the past in order to like it's so tricky, right? Like I want to use the word unshackle, but then of course that talks about slavery and I don't want to act like, oh, it's all the same. It's not all the same, but we do. But they're like the oppression of racism impacts everybody except for the elite.
Yeah, I would even say so it impacts everyone differentially. And I think it also does impact the elite. And I'll tell you why. So 2 days ago, I was doing a training, right? And it's a racial sensitivity training. And, you know, we're all engaging deeply. It's a mixed race set classroom. And one Black woman shared all that she has to do, all the labor involved before she even walks in the door for her work day, right? Mm-hmm. And about how sometimes, you know, because she doesn't want to make too many facial expressions, she doesn't want to, you know, her octave can't be too high and all the, you know, all those kinds of things. And I saw one of the men in the training, a white man, I saw him nod, right? So afterwards I inquired about what that nod was about. And I was heartened to hear him say that he said, you know, I thought about how much, you know, like because of these things, these very alive things, and because of how white our institutions are, how normed in whiteness our institutions are, then I also get to miss out on the fullness of who she is. You know what I mean? So, and I also think that in order to do this generation after generation after generation, white folks, right? That you have to dissociate yourself, numb yourself. And I think you had to give up a part of your humanity, the part that sees, that knows, that loves, And so there is a part that becomes hardened, and that is passed on from generation to generation to generation. And so you lost a sense of, you lost your humanity in many ways, right? To be able to coexist as though, all of this other stuff is not happening.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's easier for me to say that as a black person than for you to say that as a white person, to say like, oh, the elite suffered too. But
No, I actually think you're totally right. And when I'm talking about the elite, I'm not talking about like the average white man, because like even that guy's nod, my sense is like he has to code switch to go to work. And Br Brené Brown's work talks about how you cannot be invulnerable at work and then come home and be vulnerable. It's like people get like more and more and more narrow to what the window, the cultural window of tolerance is for their expression of their own aliveness. And that does absolutely impact white men too. And when I'm talking about like the ruling class, like I'm thinking of people like Trump or Mitch McConnell or Biden or Putin or these people who are like making a ton of money for a ton, like a very few people. And honestly, like all of them kind of look like comic book villains. Like it's almost like their bodies are like twisted in the toxicity of what they're doing. Like it's not good for them. And also they're the ones reaping the like financial benefit. But spiritually, I mean, I think we can just obviously see it's bankrupt.
So they definitely have some like socioeconomic benefits, living the life that they want, no limits in, on their freedoms and all the things. I talk about that too. Like, there are hierarchies within hierarchies. So no one, very, very few people are benefiting from the system as is, but not everybody knows that. The majority don't know that. The majority of even white people don't know that. You know what I mean? People of color have this lived embodied experience, and we know that unless we bought into, the lies. But yeah. So how did you get that far back into your ancestry? What tools did you?
Right. I mean, it's a good question. I mean, the thing about doing genealogy is, there are very impeccable records for my British ancestors because they were in power. And so their births, their deaths, their names, their marriages, their children were considered really important to record. And so a friend of mine who knows how to do genealogy just got onto Ancestry and looked up the names, which, we know those records are not as accessible for people who were enslaved, for Indigenous people who were not even considered citizens or people or, so that's complex. And one thing I love about the ancestral lineage healing work is like I just had someone message me who was like, I've hit a dead end with the genealogical research, but I want to connect with my ancestors. Can we do some lineage healing work together for that? And I was like, yes, and then people who are adopted, who don't know their biological family, people who are not able to find the records, you can still connect. I mean, my own ancestral guides are pre-colonization, pre-patriarchal. They are well before the recorded names, and I have deep spiritual relationships that I've developed with them over time. So, it's both, right? I feel the spiritual support of my ancestors in doing the decolonizing, anti-racist, collective liberation work that I'm trying to contribute my part to. And I can tell this story because the records favor my ancestors.
Yeah, I mean, I was recently, within the last year, just even trying to look as far back as my great grandfather. So my grandmother's, who was alive when I was alive, right? And all and in the Caribbean, and I'm pretty sure, I don't know for a fact, but I'm pretty sure this has something to do with colonization. People weren't submitting the, as soon as people were born, right? So like my great grandmother was born December 21st, I think, of 1917 or 18, but she didn't, that her papers weren't submitted until like January something. So on record, her birthday is January. And so when there's like this discrepancy, like you don't really know, and it's really hard to find, like, wait, is that the same Ignatius Jeremiah, or is that,
Because you
those
knew her
kind
birthday and you knew it wasn't January.
of... Exactly. And so yeah, there is a lot of obscurity for those particularly Indigenous folks and Afro-descended folks throughout the diaspora.
What is it like for you, like with your ancestors, like what you've been able to track back? Like how do you hold all of this with the ones that you can find? And
Most of so the fortunate, unfortunate thing is that like my living people are so young. Like my mom is 18 years older than me, her mom is 18 years older than me, her. And so I knew I was 27 before my great grandparents started dying. So I've in my life I've known three of my four great grandparents, right? And so
if you enjoy listening to Radical Remembering and would love to get the season dropped before everyone else, if you want exclusive invites to live and virtual events and could benefit from daily liberation inspiration, like affirmations, thought-provoking questions, and daily guidance, then download our free app, Living Liberated, in the App Store or on Google Play. You can also find the link below in the description box.
And I'm sure the fourth one that I didn't know, the great-grandfather, I think he lasted, I don't know what age he was, but I think I was probably in my teens or 20s before he even died. So those things are a little bit more accessible for me, but not everybody has that, that short of an age distance between them. And for me, it has also definitely been, I've been able to reach a little bit further back with my ancestral lineage healing work. And we should probably name what that is and what that process is too in a little bit. But it has been that, like, and then it confirms. I have also done like DNA tests and different things like that that confirm. When I was younger, also, my mother told me about this book written by Eric Williams, who was the first prime minister of Trinidad. And he has the book is like the documents of West Indian history or something like that. He has records printed in this book about, and I have the book right here, right next to me, but I've never read the book. I'm going by what she's told me. She had told me that the African people in Trinidad were from Nigeria and they were Yoruba, right? Mm-hmm. So I know that verbally. And then I also took the test and I see that I am majority Nigerian with, but also other parts of like West and Central Africa too, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Togo. And that's largely because all those places were really the Gold Coast. They were one place at one point in time too. So that, as well as the ancestral lineage healing work. And so to explain to you all, and you can help me fill in the gaps, Angela, to explain to you all what an ancestral lineage healing work is, it's a modality that was developed by Daniel Foer. And we are both trained in that modality. And so it's a process where in collaboration with a practitioner, you create a ritual, a space of ritual safety, and you are guided into a practice and engagement with your ancestors, right? You start with your four primary lineages, like your mother's mother, your father's mother, their lines, I should say, especially if they're living, your father's mother's line and your father's father's line. And then, you get in engagement with them in a spiritual way, of course, And it also has been what I've seen. And also for myself, it has also even developed my capacity to engage and to hear and perceive spiritual information, right? And so I've learned in the process some really meaningful things. And I'll like, for example, in one of our retreats, it was March of last year, I believe, we were, I forgot what exactly we were doing, but on my maternal, my grandmother's father's line, right? So they showed me like way back that they started in Sudan, right? And that they came from another form of colonization is how they described it. So not European colonization, but Arabic colonization. They showed how they were showing me how they walked across to West Africa and that they were in Mali, right? And so I was like, after that, I was like, oh my God, do I have ancestors from Mali? And I go and I look at my DNA report. I do.
That's amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. They were also able to fill in some of the gap and tell me like in that particular lineage, like they were warriors and that, some of the ways in which that trouble, that cultural trouble and oppression and colonization impacted them is that there was some sort of trauma. They were warriors for a long time, but with one particular grandfather in that lineage, there was extreme trauma when it was just like beyond, a little being a soldier. It was like, you know, and so as a means of survival, they kind of hardened, right? So they were all soldiers, including my great grandfather was a soldier. And I laugh only because that's not even something that I was fully conscious of for most of my. He lived in Trinidad while I grew up here, you know, and so point of the story is that they were undeveloped in their, you know, in their feminine characteristics or divine feminine energy, and overdeveloped in their masculine energy. And I say this, and I give these details to give image to those of you who are not familiar with ancestral lineage healing and what that process might yield, to be able to share like some of the rich details, because I do know that Afro-descended people are at a loss when it comes to trying to find the story, and that it provokes a lot of grief even when we talk about trying to trace your ancestry. So the good news is that there are other ways. There are other ways. I'll also, in addition to putting your trailer in the description box underneath our talk, I'll also put your contact information, my contact information for those people who are interested in doing ancestral lineage healing work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I did ancestral healing work for a long time before that through family constellation work, which, you know, just like anything, is deeply impacted by whoever your practitioner is. But also that practice was taken, appropriated, inspired by the Zulu tribe, and was taken by a German man named Bert Hellinger. And my sense of that work is that, like, for years, I was letting the troubled dead run through my body, like trying to heal them through my body in community. And it had massive negative impact on my health and well-being, even though it was extremely powerful and I believe it's real. I don't think this is like a problem with taking indigenous technology and taking it out of context and out of community. Because it's like, if I go to a retreat and I or a workshop and I do this healing work and then I go back home, but I don't have anything to hold me, it does stuff. It opens doors to troubled spirits. The reason that I do Daniel's work, which, you know, he talks about, is cultural repair work. It's for people who've lost the practice of ancestral reverence and connection because of either, you know, colonization and Christianization, or, you know, it's like it was made illegal even for my ancestors in Europe to have ancestral reverence practices. It was considered sacrilegious because it's so, I mean, I know you know this from our experience, and we've talked about this before. It's so empowering. I liken it to, rather than feeling like I have an anvil on my back of all my troubled ancestors, and all I've done five lineages, they were all so troubled. There was so much violence. Like, you don't burn people alive and then be okay. It sets up a pattern of intergenerational trauma. I had family members who murdered each other. It's not just a harm that goes out, it starts to eat you up inside. And I was born with that, like, in, you know, on my body. But now it feels like I have a good jet pack. Like, my ancestors, who are bright and well in spirit and who understand the harms that they did and see the impact, you know, see how it's impacted me and the world, and, you know, and understand what I'm trying to do. They're so supportive of me that sometimes it feels like I'm moving almost a little faster than my own body can handle. And I'm like, everybody, chill out. You know, like, I am in a body, you're not. I have limitations, you don't, you know. But I do think of, you know, if the premise of the work is that the dead are real and they're not all equally well in spirit, the unwell dead are holding down the edges of the cultural troubles. They're holding it down. They're still believing in white supremacy and patriarchy and capitalism and colonization. They're still holding it down energetically. And so even when the living are like trying to take that off of us and be like, this is a mess, we need to do reparations, we need to do recognition, we need to have totally new ways of, or old ways of, you know, older ways of doing things. As long as the dead are troubled and holding it down, it's really hard. There's way more dead people than living people, you know, I think, although there's a lot of people right now. So, but it still seems like probably a lot more dead people. Nonetheless, we need the dead to help us, is the way I think of it. So for me, it's always, I'm never just doing the ancestral work for personal healing. It's always with eye to collective healing, and particularly like when I work with European descended people or white identified people, I'm really looking to like, I want to work with people who want their ancestors to support them in undoing, shifting the cultural, the intersectional interlocking systems of oppression. And it's fucking wild. Sorry, I'm swearing on your podcast. Like when we do the work together, for instance, like when there is, like when I remember a session where when your ancestors were being liberated from the container of prayer, when they were being ancestralized, when they were well in spirit, like I asked all my ancestors to bow in reverence to this and to feel like thousands of people bowing to your people. It like every time it feels so moving to me. It's not just me and you, it's my people and your people. And I think it's tricky. I mean, it makes sense to me why a lot of Black people and people of color would, or people of the global majority would want to do the work with other people of the global majority or other Black people. That makes sense to me. And there is something bridge building powerful. I mean, in our relationship, I think we've felt that, of like, oh, there, it's transpersonal, it's not just us loving each other, but it's like our people harmonizing and working well together. And I think we need that for the collective liberation.
Yeah, that reminds me of one time when I was, I don't even remember what the issue or whatever. I was and one morning, I was at my altar and I was meditating and I just heard this tuning, like a tuning fork, whatever it was in the background. And I look over and I'm like, those are Angela's ancestors, because that's how they showed up when you and I had done that work. So it is bridge building and all those things and healing and restoration and different things like that. And I like that you're what you're bringing up and naming is that we've been trying to go about liberation the wrong way, right? So in many ways, we've been treating liberation as though it's a cognitive thing. Like, if I just change my thoughts, I'll be good. And then if those thoughts change my behavior, boom, liberation is done. If we get a little bit of social power, economic power. But what you're naming here is that it is not purely a manifestation of what's in the material world, that in order for us to be collectively liberated, we have to address the spiritual world as well, which addresses history, which addresses ancestry. But there is really no divide between that spiritual world and here, because that history is in our bodies. It's in our cell. It's in the morphogenic field around each one of our cells that tells it, what to turn on, what to turn off, and all those kinds of things. So really honoring that you've named for us. I talk about it also in my work, but I'm enjoying how you're talking about the fact that this is it's only half the story if you try to address it that way, because there is an investment, and with our unwell dead and keeping things the same.
Yeah. And, I guess just the way that I think of healing almost as like sedimentary, like there's layers, right? Of like, there's just so many different layers of healing in ourselves and, in our relationships. But like culturally, there's so many layers of healing. So it's not like I think, oh, I just need to heal my ancestors and it's all done. It's also not like, oh, I just need to make a film where, in particular, white identified people can start to see what it looks like to acknowledge, reckon, learn about your ancestry, like face what happened and be moved by it. It seems like so many people, even all the arguments around critical race theory and all this stuff, right? Like one day I went down a terrible rabbit hole on the internet. I was like, what are people's arguments around against critical race theory? So I Googled it and I found this Southern white politician and she was like, this is going to make white children feel terrible about themselves. I was like, oh my God, this is, I mean, and of course, this is not a new argument, but like, this is on her political web page. This is not just her personal opinion. She is in office. She is a member of the ruling class. And for me, it feels like, okay, it's okay to feel, first of all, it's okay to feel uncomfortable. I mean, when I emailed the Pequot Museum to say, "Hey, my ancestor participated in a massacre against your people. I'd like to talk to you." Writing that email and getting ready to send it was one of the scariest things I've ever done in my life. It seems ridiculous because it's sending an email. I send a lot of emails. It's not scary. And so much because I hadn't finished like reckoning with my ancestor who was part of that. Right before I hit send, I cannot even make this up. I went to hit send and my computer just shut down and died.
And died, not
I
even
mean,
like,
it didn't, well, it didn't die forever, but it just was like
but
done. And I was like, why did, and I didn't, like, why did my computer shut down? Like, and I just was like, no, okay. Like I opened it up again and I was like, if I have to write this email again, I'm going to write it again and I'm going to send it again. And then I did finally send it.
Liberation is 100% about being in right relationship with our power. It's so easy from day to day to disconnect from our source and forget who we really are. On our app, Living Liberated, we have the tools to keep you plugged in. You'll find a library of affirmations, guided meditations, guided journeys, and tapping sequences to keep you in a state of alignment with who you really are. Topics range from self-love, healthy relationships, activating our DNA, to guided journeys with your ancestors. Download our free app, Living Liberated, and start your free 7-day trial now in the App Store or Google Play. You can also find the link for Plugged in the description box below.
And then I had to do some psychopomp work with my ancestor, who had said to me before I even knew what he did, when I dropped in with him and asked if I, because I asked the spirits of the land, the first people of this land, and my ancestors, is it okay if I do this project before I ever committed to doing it? And everyone said yes to me except him. And I didn't know why. And what he said to me was, don't humiliate me. And what I said to him was like, it is not my intention to humiliate you. It is my intention to find out the truth and name it. And then he and I had to do like a whole reckoning process and healing process. And it made a huge difference. And now he is very much in support of my work, my life. I love him. I know that might seem weird. Like, I love my ancestor. I don't love what he did. He no longer loves what he did. He like drives me in this project. He brings people to me. I just met somebody who lives in another on another continent who messaged me on my birthday this week and said, "I noticed your last name on this website I was on, but didn't know anything about the film, and was like, I have this ancestor, Jacob Waterhouse, and mentioned all his ancestors." And I was like, "I can't believe this." Like, it's like the ancestors are working to bring us together to be like, "Please, please make this right." I mean, we all make mistakes. That mistake was a horrendous one. I hope to never make a mistake that big in my own life. But we can repair it. And I believe we can repair it even after we're dead. And I will just say the Indigenous writer Pat McCabe, after Queen Elizabeth died, she wrote the most incredible Facebook post about like because I was like, bye-bye, colonizer. See ya, dead lady. Like, I wasn't like, oh, the queen. Like, I don't have any romanticization of that shit, But she was like, we don't want to hold the dead to their harms that they did when they were living, basically. We need their help. We need her help. Like, I will pray for her spirit to become well. And I mean, a friend of mine sent it and was like, this is exactly what you're talking about. I was like, wow, I was so moved. And I believe that is the work of the ancestral lineage healing we're doing. That's the work of the film I'm doing. That's the work of the liberation work you're doing and all the anti-racist education you're doing. It's like there's all these different layers of like thinking, feeling. We got to be able to feel it. We have to be able to heal the spiritual part of ourselves and the collective. It's not just one thing.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. You named grief actually a little while ago. What does that grief look like for white people when they start to reckon with
Yeah.
all of this?
It's interesting. You had asked earlier, like, what was it like for my dad? I love my dad so much. And he's one of my favorite people, and we're so different. He, in the 60s, we lived in, my family is from the Bay Area, and he was taking a massage class, and he would like drive around the protests for civil rights so he could get to his massage class. I'm like, okay, you really missed an opportunity. I mean, he wasn't like against it, but he wasn't participating. He was like seeing it as a traffic jam. And I too have seen protests as a traffic jam in my life. And, you know, like before I really understood like what was going on, it's like there's, you know, my own before Ferguson, I don't feel like I fully understood. And there's no reason for me not to. I grew up listening to gangster rap. I heard people saying like, fuck the police. I understood something about it, but I didn't understand it wholly until I saw American military tanks on the street of Ferguson, Missouri, aimed at nonviolent Black protesters who were saying, like, you killed our unarmed child. And then something shifted for me where I was like, oh, this is everywhere. This is all the time. This is the way it's set up, you know? And so that's, you know, my dad and I are very different, but like in terms of grief, he's not super great at like feeling his feelings or emoting, or, you know, he kind of feels like shut down or angry, or, you know, like, or he's loving, but it's, I don't know how to explain it. So it's interesting as I'm making the film and I'm like, hey, this thing happened. And he's like, oh, wow. And, you know, he's so understated. Like, even in the film and the clips, like you can see in the trailer him saying, like, this is terrible. Like, I never knew anything about this, you know, and he's not against reckoning with it. But I think his version of reckoning is to like just gently acknowledge it and kind of like turn away and shut down. And he's almost 80 years old, you know. I'm just grateful that he's not like, what are you doing? You know, he's like, yeah, I'll get in a car and drive 11,000 miles with you and let you bring me to Indigenous people and talk to them. And you know, so, you know, he'll do it. For me, even right now, as we're talking, like I feel like I'm always a little bit on the edge of tears when I think about how messed up things have gotten. And it's not because this is who we are and this is like a natural human quality to like harm each other and like oppress each other. I don't believe that. And you know, just last week, I was watching a video of called Birth of a White Nation, where this scholar, historian, who's a white American, was laying out the details. This is on YouTube, like laying out the details of like in this year, people in the, you know, American colonies were called English, and 20 years later, they were called white. That was the first time in the world, this is like 1680 something or something. That's the first time in the world anybody was named as white. Why was that? What happened in that 20 years? And she pretty much lays out that there was a rebellion, an uprising of in white indentured servants and enslaved Black people who lived together, worked together, slept together, married each other. They were in community together, and they were like, these land-owning ruling class people are oppressing us. And for a year they were in uprising and uprising and uprising. Finally, the British military came over, pushed that down, squashed that. And there's literal like written documentation of the colonists writing to England saying, we're going to use a divide and conquer strategy. And all the uprisings stopped when they started giving the indentured white people a little bit more. And W.E. Du Bois called that, I think he called it like a psychological wage. It's like just giving people like the sense that they're important, that made them feel like they were like connected to. So like all these people who think they're connected to Trump, I'm like, he does not care about you. He's not going to help you get housing or healthcare or food or work or anything. Like, why are all these people aligned? And it's this is this thing that's really only been around for like 400 years. And I'm like, we can undo this.
I guess an important part of grief too is allowing the feeling and not running from it, leaning into it, right? Because, well, as simple as that is, it's countercultural, right? Because patriarchy, the way whiteness has also been normed in institutions to think, is what is promoted. Who cares what you feel? What do you think? You know? So, like, leaning into it and allowing it, not running away from it. Also, name running away from it by, I guess, being defensive, trying to make a joke and make light of hard situations, suppressing it after the conversation is done and not allowing the continued processing. And I mean, I say that as I think about what your journey has been, right? So you said, you know, you liked and you listened to rap and all those kinds of things in your earlier development. So there were some seeds planted. You grew up in the Bay Area, which is at least explicitly progressive, right?
Yeah.
And for progressive issues, and particularly if you're near Oakland, there was some change in around the time that you were born, some social political changes and consciousness raising around blackness with the Black Panther Party being so close, right? So there were some seeds, right? But it wasn't until 2014 that that this big event happened that you saw in a different way. For a lot of people, it wasn't until Trayvon Martin, and I believe that was 2015. For a lot of people, it wasn't until George Floyd in 2020, right? And racial identity development models, both white racial identity models, Black racial identity models, and the other ones that there are other models that talk about people of the global majority as well. They talk about Bill Cross, who developed the first Black racial identity model, talks about that as an encounter experience, right? So you had been moving through the world like, oh, wait, like not even thinking about your race or that you have a race or any of those things. And then there's this big encounter experience and you see the world completely differently.
Yeah, that's I hadn't heard of that before. I mean, I will say it's not like I had never thought about racism or anything like that. I think what the difference is I didn't understand that it was systemic. That was like the birth of my systemic lens, not the birth of my concern. I mean, of course, I was in LA during the Rodney King uprising. And I watched that video and I wasn't like, oh, I'm sure he deserved to be beaten. Like there was no part of me that thought like that's okay. My dad watched all the O.J. Simpson trial, for instance, and I didn't watch it, but my dad feels very, very adamant. He gets so mad even now if people bring it up because he feels like he was not guilty and that it was orchestrated. And he was like, I watched it every day. Those cops were lying. You could see that they were lying. They would say different things. They would say one thing during the trial and the news would say something else. He would call the news and be like, what are you talking about? That's not what happened today. So I didn't have that experience. And you know, some of my friends, especially white friends, when I talk about this, will be like, well, your dad loved O.J. Simpson because he loves football. And I'm like, yes, and he watched it. I mean, my dad is not a scholar. He has a high school education, but he is able to watch something and see the news and be like, they're saying something different than what actually happened today. So I'm not pretending that I'm ever going to be able to completely undo my internalized white supremacy culture. That's an ongoing, lifelong, journey. And there are often times where I'll be like, uh-oh, that's weird. Or, even today when we were messaging before this, and I was like, oh, I wonder about the wording of this thing you're sending me. And I was an editor. Is it supportive of you, or is it like a intrusive, or it's like it's always a it's different. It is different. Like if you were a white friend, I would be like, and you were talking about something anti-Black, and so I'm like asking you to reword that. It's super tricky, right? I think for me though, what happened with Ferguson in terms of that awakening that you're talking about was I can no longer act like this isn't a systemic intentional thing. And I can no longer pretend that it's like us on a, the side or something. And right around that time or before that time, like I'm somebody who was queer identified, and I remember all the stuff about like same-sex marriage and all of that. And at some point, I said to some friends, like, I feel like climate is the only issue that I can actually really get behind because it impacts everybody. And then Ferguson changed that for me. I was like, oh, and then of course now people talk so much more about intersectionality, and it's like I can't extricate climate catastrophe from racism or patriarchy or, so all those things are all together. And I think that to me, that felt like the birth of my sense of intersectionality with how I spend my life. And I think of Michael Brown as a deep spiritual teacher, and I wish he didn't have to be. It continues to be like a deep source of grief for me that he's not alive. And I didn't know him, but I just feel his spirit. And it's, he was a child. And, you know, just because he was a large child, you know, doesn't mean he wasn't a child. You
Yeah.
know, it's painful.
Yeah, very much so. And the racial identity development models, they don't think that there was nothing before, but that these encounter experiences, now your identity is impacted in a different way. So what you
Right. I
explained,
see what you're saying.
what you explained speaks of an identity shift, right?
Right. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that for me. That makes sense.
Yeah. And so what did you do that continues, right? And meaning from 2014 until now, this has been a liberation journey for you. I don't know if you would always have said liberation, whatever, but it's been a liberation journey for you, how you get free from and emancipate from the colonized ways of thinking about race and all of its intersections. What I know that you've done a lot of learning, but can you speak to some of that for us?
Speaking to like what I've learned over this time or what.
Your intentional acts of decolonization. If there are people who are looking at this and say, like, okay, well, I've had an encounter experience, now what? What would you
Right.
offer?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny when I think back to that time around Ferguson, the first thing I did was reach out to a friend of mine who I knew from Constellation work, who is a Black elder. Who I really loved, and a Black queer elder, and I said, I imagine that you must be going through so much grief right now. Can I make you dinner? And he and his partner came over, and I made them dinner. And I like when he was before he left, he was like, I can hear my mom saying, like, you can't ask this, but like, can I have the leftovers? And I was like, of course. His partner was like, oh my God. His partner, who's white, was like, you can't ask that. I was like, he so can. This is the whole point, is,
Right.
you know, like it's small things, right? Like just me being like, I imagine you're hurting. Can I help? Like, you know, I can't undo this all the way, but I can care about you. It's, to me, it's a lot about like I speak out pretty intensely about this stuff on social media, and a lot of white friends have messaged me and been like, you've really given me the courage to speak up more. So that's a thing. And in my friendships, like, I don't know, like in my relationships, one time my dad picked me up from a trip at the airport, and the first thing he said to me was they killed another Black man, you know? So it's very much like no one in my life doesn't know that I care about this stuff because it's the heart of my life. I don't, you know, I'm an abolitionist. I see the police as a racist institution. I want it abolished. I want community care and mutual aid. I want the way that things have been set up to be like governmentally to be completely different. I don't think about like representation, like having a Black president did not change things. Obama told the protesters at Ferguson to go home. It's not about like representation, it's about a complete dismantling of the way that things are set up. And I, in order to do that, we have to see how it was constructed against us. And how that impacts us differently. And white people are incentivized to not see that in a way that Black people and people of color are not. And so it's much easier to be like, this is landing on me. This is bullshit. Like, what is this? But white people are given, like, you know, the GI Bill. They're given, you know, like my grandparents were able to buy a house in an area that was, you know, blocked from anybody who wasn't wholly white in 1951. Those little bits, I mean, they're huge and they're massive, they impact people a lot, but like those little bits of benefit have kept white people from being like, wait a second, this is all messed up. And so it's like about being willing to be like, those little benefits have massive spiritual, economic. I mean, somebody, a Black author, I can't think of her name right now, but she wrote a book called The Sum of Us. Last year, I think, that's all about the economic devastation of racism and how the like racism is destroying our economy, which I'm, you know, really hoping to interview her for my film because Like one anti-racist, like white person said to me, you know, in your film, you're talking about emotional stuff, you're talking about spiritual stuff, but some people only care about money. You might want to talk to this woman and like get this in here too. It's like it hurts us on so many different levels. So I don't know. It feels very much like there isn't a day that goes by that I'm not thinking about this stuff. And I just like was in a class with an organization called White Awake, and they were really talking about the difference between liberal anti-racism and radical anti-racism. And what they said was liberal anti-racism is representation, diversity, inclusion, and radical representation is the recognition that like 99% of us are being economically oppressed and like, you know, I would say emotionally, spiritually oppressed. That's not quite how they were talking about it, for the benefit of very, very few, and that we need to like dismantle all these laws, all and make reparations so that it's, you know, we can start. It's not that hard. We have the money. We're blowing all kinds of money on ridiculous murder, you know, but to really somehow just give us like a big reset, I think it's actually totally doable.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. So in your journey, I'm hearing, well, lots of intentionality, but I'm hearing learning. I also know, you didn't necessarily say it, but I know that you've also taken a lot of courses that also keep you. It's like we have to be in rehab, right? Like, for the ways in which, you know, in which whiteness has been so institutionalized within the individual, but also within the system, and how that keeps replicating itself. So I know you've also taken a lot of courses. And as we close, I want to ask you a question of cross-racial friendships. In Dr. Marissa Franco's book, Platonic, there is a chapter where she talks about cross-racial friendships and the things that are necessary in order to have cross-racial friendships, right? How have you been able to successfully have cross-racial friendships? I feel safe with you. I feel like, and I don't feel safe with all white people. I start off with, it's funny, the same training the other day, a white guy was like, I wonder sometimes how black people perceive me. I was like, oh, well, when I see you, I'm like, danger, 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 right? Until we engage. And actually the first time that we engaged, I was like, oh, he's okay. He's a safe one, right? And I won't give that up because it's because we live in a still racist society and it's necessary for my survival, you know. Although there are many other parts of that I wanted that I'm going and work on giving up. But anyway, how do you do it? What do you and you sh you shared also empathy, that how you shared empathy with that gentleman earlier. But
I think it's something about like, one, I try to be pretty transparent. Like, I'm probably gonna fuck this up sometimes. Please know, I want you to tell me. It's not that it's not scary for me, or I don't feel worried, or like feel worried that I'm gonna feel embarrassed or ashamed or something, or if I mess up or I overstep or I do something, and I'm tracking it. Like even in this conversation, it's so weird because I'm like, you're interviewing me. What's the balance of how much I'm talking? So you're talking, I'm talking more than you. I noticed that. So I'm tracking that some. And I try to be as transparent as possible and just be like, anytime I mess up, please tell me. I will repair this with you, which is a value that I have in all my friendships. But I am really, I include racialized harm, ignorance. No matter, I mean, what, like if this has been an identity shift for me for like the last, you know, not even quite 10 years, I have not been living with this reality in the way that I'm holding it as long as you have. And I'm always going to have things I don't see and I don't know. And it's scary. Like, even as I'm making my film, you know, Bayo Akumalafe talks about like not trying to dismantle whiteness from the like energy of whiteness. And I'm like, oh, how do I make this film about reckoning with my ancestors' harm, my white settler ancestors' harm, without bringing some kind of unconscious internalized whiteness to it? So I ask people like you to be on my consulting team and, you know, have you watch parts of it and look at parts of it and let me know where I'm messing up, you know? And so that's for me, like with my work, my friendship, my clients, anybody who works with me, I'm like, let me know. You know, I think that's part of it.
Can I tell you how much I enjoy? Because you said you because speaking, and I gave you the example of the black woman, how she spoke entering an institution, right? Me being one of the few black people in white spaces, legit all of my professional life until I left the workforce, until I left and started working for myself, there's a heavy cognitive load as you code switch, as you frame switch, as you manage impressions, as you manage deal with microaggressions and stupid things people say, like, oh my God, I didn't recognize that was you. Your hair is so different, really. Like, my face is the same though, right? And so there, I got a little bit of pleasure hearing that you have some cognitive load there. You know, not you, Angela, the person, but you, the white
Yeah.
person, that because that could so, thank you for carrying some of the load for me so I don't have to do all the carrying, right? Like,
Yeah.
that's what it felt like. Good. That's what, you know, white people need to do the work because, you know, white people used to enter in the space and it's just like, I'm here. Hey, how's everything going? But I like that you name that you're, you know, that what you're naming is that it's this, you know, intentional, lifelong process that requires dismantling in our interpersonal relationships and in our institutions and what have you. And I think that that's important. I'll also say from the other side of being, you know, your friend, what made me feel really safe in the from the beginning is that you named it. I had white friends during 2020, you know, during 2020 when we were all locked down. So there were a whole lot of Zoom catch-ups and everything like that. Who ain't say shit about race? Who ain't say nothing about George Floyd? And there are people who our social workers are, you know, and I'm not bad talking them. Should y'all hear this? Love y'all too, right? But we didn't talk about it, and that it hurt. It hurt that. So we're not going to name this at one of the most critical times
Yeah.
in history. We're not going to name this, you know, and it would have meant so much for me for them to name it and to say, I see you. I see your struggle. I see what you and your community have been going through.
Yeah.
Without, I mean, there's, I want to also name that there are ways that people do that are self-serving as well. And I'm not talking about
Totally.
that
Yeah.
are born of guilt. And I'm not talking about that.
Right.
And I have not sensed that in our interaction, but you also name things too. You're like, you know, like that's the effect of colonization. I'm like, oh shit. You know what I mean? That is the effect of colonization when I've told you personal things or family things and different things like that. And it helps to that I don't have to be the one always bringing it up, and that you're so working that you also help me hold a mirror to me and say, like, nah, you're not crazy. Like, this is some real shit and this is some racial shit. You know what I mean? So I appreciate that. And I appreciate this conversation. So now, as we come to a close, I want to remind you to like, share this podcast episode. If you want to get in touch with Angela, again, it's going to be in the description box. Angela always also does restorative empathy counseling. So in addition to the ancestral lineage healing, you can also on her website find out how you can contribute, particularly white identified folk who have benefited, you know, from white supremacy and white privilege in the country, how you can donate to the film to get the message across to raise the awareness of other white folks about this reckoning that's needed and how they too can do that. So before we close, Angela, do you have anything you'd like to say?
I mean, I want to say to your non-white identified listeners, like, thanks. If you got to here, thanks for putting up with this the whole time. Like, what is happening? What's this white lady? Why are we listening to her? Bow of respect and humility, for, you know, any irritation that may have caused, and open to feedback, you know, really from your listeners, not just you. And just that I have like the most profound love and respect for you and your work. And it's really, truly like a joy and an honor to get to be part of it in any way. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for time well spent. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you've loved what we've had to share and want to be the first to get releases of our new episodes and learn about events, download our free app, Living Liberated, in the Apple or Google Play Store.